Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com. Folks, I'm in the heart of Jerusalem in Nachlaot on Nisim Bachar Street at the Y Cafe. Y Cafe. Why? Because before we get to our next stop, which is Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, Talk Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer, we need to understand what's happening on the ground here in the Land of Israel and in politics, which is really the will of the people, or the almost will of the people. Politics, the art of the possible. And, of course, there's nobody more possible to do it with than our good friend Jeremy Sultan, our Knesset insider, KnessetJeremy.com. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Yisha. I see our coffee's just arrived.
Yeah, it's funny because they got it backwards. They put the hafuch latte coffee for you, for me, and the chai masala thing for you, but we know that's the opposite. The opposite is true. I'm going for chai today, and you're going for coffee, and they look beautiful here at Y Cafe.
Yours looks better, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I saw them making it before, and I'm like, I want that. It smells cinnamony. It smells... You know, actually, the truth is, I've got a cold right now a little bit. My kids have got stomach stuff. It's a transition period in the weather. It's cool outside for really the first time, and yet, no rain, Jeremy. What's the deal with that? I mean, I don't know if it's a Knesset issue, but can you help me out understand why the rain has not fallen?
Yeah, I think we need to do a better job praying, as you mentioned at the top. But also, this is the first time I've put on my sweater this winter, so... Something's up. I think we're getting closer.
It's kind of weirdly coincidental that you and I are both, like, I'm wearing my first jeans and first sweater of the season, and so too are you. And it's like, and here we are in a street corner in
outside.
Jerusalem. That's right. It's fun and it's very multicultural. We're literally all kinds of folks walking past us wondering why we're doing radio on the street. Jeremy, there's so much happening right now. Let's get to the big thing, the Trump thing. Okay, Trump winning what for a lot of people seemed like an improbable victory. I must admit and say, for me, it didn't seem so improbable. And the reason is not because I'm such a political prophet. I'm not. But I was just doing something very simple. I was following Twitter. I was looking at Trump's rallies. And I was looking at Clinton's rallies. And it was just like, there is a landswell. I'm not a political prophet, but I can tell that people are psyched about this Trump thing. He's a character. He's also what has been forgotten, a total American, bombastic, rich, reality TV, something a cross between reality TV and WWF, you know, and he's like, to me, it's like total American, you know, like a real like Hollywood / New York / mogul type person, right from the past, a blast from the past, a type of, you'll steal one of those monopolies and all that kind of, you know, the AT&T's and the steel monopolies of the past, this kind of like huge character. And then he goes in and he wins. It has a lot of impact seemingly in Israel. I wanted to ask you first thing about Trump's win and about some of the reactions that Israeli politicians have started kind of pushing out there. And this nervousness that there is change on the horizon.
Sure. So that's a lot. Let's try to break that down. First of all, in terms of the victory, there's one thing that a poll cannot look at, and that's enthusiasm. You cannot measure an emotion in a scientific model. And when people say that it's the Yom Kippur of the pollsters, I think that's going a little bit too far. But on the other hand, we do have a situation where we see that they were off by 2 or 3 points, not by 10 or 20 points, but by 2 or 3. And I went into the little bowels there of the actual polls, and I saw there was one thing that...
And you're a poll bowler.
You are.
If people don't know, if you go to KnessetJeremy.com, Jeremy is a numbers guy. You love numbers. You crunch numbers, and you love polling numbers.
Yeah, so everyone wants to know how you get something wrong. That's how you're able to learn from things. And I went in, and I saw something very interesting. If you looked specifically at the people said that they were 100% sure that they were going to vote on Election Day, Trump actually did have even a popular vote victory in a lot of these poll models. Now, the thing is that most of these poll models, they say if someone says 70% or higher that they're going to vote, we're going to include them in the poll. And what ended up happening, one would assume, is a lot of these people that said 70%, 80%, 90% sure that they're going to go and they're going to vote for Clinton, in the end they decided that they'd rather do something else with their Tuesday. So that's a great way to be able to explain that from the American side. On the Israeli side, people were shocked. I mean, you can just see screen caps of any of the TV stations that we're carrying here in Israel. Everyone was led here to believe that, and, you know, to a great extent, the United States as well, you know, Israel's not alone here, that Donald Trump had absolutely no shot. I was at the U.S. Ambassador's Party in Tel Aviv watching it with other prominent journalists and politicians. And, you know, I was talking with the ministers even, and everyone's saying, oh, so how much do you think, Jeremy, 320 electoral votes for Hillary Clinton? What do you think, 340, 350? That was the type of conversation that was going on in terms of the country's elite from all sides. And what ended up happening as that night unfolded and the next morning came around is that a lot of people from the establishment of the Israeli political side, and this includes even people in this right-wing conservative nationalist coalition that we have now, were just shocked. They had absolutely no idea how to deal with this.
Jeremy.
Yeah.
It wasn't very different than how Netanyahu won. Same type of scenario. They told us that the polls were off. They told us that Netanyahu's his time has passed. He's definitely going to lose. The media was saying it for months beforehand. And then when it came down to it, it was again the same thing, a kind of groundswell. And then similarly, after he won, the same type of language was used against him. He's a racist. He hates Arabs. It's because of this video. And it was almost like the same playbook. And interestingly enough, to the detriment of the people who are usually good at playbook, which is the radical left.
Yeah, look, it's a great example you're giving. There's also the example, I guess, you could give of the Brexit. You have the rejection of FARC down in in South America. You have the conservative sweep there in the UK elections a little over a year ago now. All of these things are part of a very obvious anti-establishment wave. We saw that also in the regional elections in France. I can just give so many examples throughout the entire Western free country order that we just see there is an anti-establishment wave of people who are sick with the elite. They're sick with the upper class that they feel are not actually giving them a good deal. So because of that, you see a lot of people voting anti.
But the media is not letting us in on that. The media is not cluing you in. The media is telling you, no, there's no such a thing. It's absolutely a landslide for the other side. So there's, you know, you're talking to me about polls, but there's a sense that the media is complicit with trying to spin that the people are against this, and yet the people are telling not only elites, political elites, but also media elites, stop lying to us. We have a different will and interest.
Well, listen, we have different elites, right? We have elites at the head of the economic sphere. We have elites in academia. We have celebrities in terms of the arts. We have elites in terms of the media. They're all working, you know, in the same place. I'll tell you, when I go to weddings, they're all sitting at the same table. Okay, someone who thinks because they're in a different sector of the economy that because of that they're not sitting together and colluding, so that's just not the case. What you have here, like I said, is a situation where people are saying, I want to feel that I have a part in this democracy. I want to feel that my views are actually being expressed. People are just sick of hearing politicians say something and then not actually follow through. How many times have we heard the Levi Eshkol famous saying, I promised, but I didn't promise to fulfill my promise. So people are starting to feel that throughout the entire Western world. And that brings us to the situation where people are trying to go in a different direction. So now what Israeli politicians are trying to do, right and left, is see, is Trump for real? Where is Trump going to go from here?
And it's a little early. It's like they're begging for answers. It's like days in. It's like there's this, I keep on feeling like, hey, guys, relax. Let the chips fall. Let's see who gets into the various positions. I mean, it's like they want everything right now. And there's already been statements made by Israeli politicians really to both sides. Famously, I think, at least famously in my mind, is that Naftali Bennett, who is the education minister, came out strong saying, look, this is not just an election of a man. It's a signal. And the signal is that this is the death of the Palestinian state. It's not moving forward. And I'll break that down saying that the people of Israel don't want it. And that's already been shown in the last Israeli election. And now the Americans are going to, at least minimally, take the pressure off, given that there's going to be all these. The word Republicans is not, it's not clear enough. It's not an issue of Republicans. It's an issue of pro-Israel folks that have been anti-Palestinian the Palestinian state and anti the division of land and anti putting pressure on Israel, folks especially like the vice president elect, who has really been a stalwart friend of Israel, maybe Rudy Giuliani and other people, John Bolton. So there's definitely a sense that Bennett was saying, hey, something here has very much changed and we better get ready for it. We better push for new policies against two-state, kill two-state. And then there are others, just like yesterday, when Defense Minister Lieberman said, hey, you know, surely we're going to be able to build only within the settlement blocks. And even Dory Gold, and this really ticked me off, Dory Gold says, you know, we're still moving towards a two-state solution, but we need defensible borders and all this old language. And as though some of these other politicians are saying, hey, it's not really such a new time. Just calm down. We'll have a little bit more freedom, but don't tell me that we've now revolted against the ideas of the past. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. What Minister Bennett is coming and saying is, guys, you guys are not realizing what's happening here. You need to wake up. You have to understand that we have an opportunity. We have a president who's willing to listen to us. And for people who are like, I want to know what's happening, there's a very simple way to know that. There's a very easy formula. You see who he appoints to which positions. Because when you're talking about someone like Donald Trump, he's a political outsider. He's coming, he's willing to take fresh ideas, but there's going to be a lot of influence for whoever it is that's going to take the key positions in his administration. If Hillary Clinton was president, we would know how she would act. It would not matter who the Secretary of State is. Here, there's a lot of weight. We want to see who that person is. So far, the only person we know 100% is obviously the vice president-elect. We do know that there's also
mention
the
his name,
chief.
It's Mike Pence.
Yes.
Mike Pence, a former governor of Indiana, and really a person who is not only a friend of Israel per se, but also a friend of Jews in Judea and Samaria, and has a lot of relationships, has toured in the past in these places, and has shown his support for that.
Yeah, and a person who, as you said, knows Israel very well. And what you have on the other side of that are announced positions. We know, you know, who he's announcing for chief of staff, who he's announcing for chief strategist. But there have been plenty of times in the course of history that you did not have the person who was originally announced actually take the office.
Really?
Yes. So what you want to do is you want to see what happens on January 20th. You want to see who's in which positions. We've also had situations, and President Obama also had this, where you need to get the votes in the Senate in order to pass somebody and get them into a cabinet position. So it could be that we'll be seeing different people than, again, the people who are first announced for these positions. But once the people who actually take those positions take that office, that gives us a really good feel of what it is that we're looking forward to. And everyone's trying to throw all these names around. Everyone said Newt Gingrich was going to be Secretary of State. Now we find out he won't even be a cabinet minister. Chris Christie, who was considered for the VP spot, and some, you know, the AG and a lot of other big positions, is also, it looks like, not going to get anything. So let's wait. Let's see. Like you said, there's, you know, over two months here until he takes office. And over that first week, he's going to go ahead and make those appointments. And then we'll know which direction he's going in. If we see that he's going towards establishment people, we might see a lot of the same policies. But if he continues to bring in more and more outsiders into these insider positions, or people that are part of the establishment but have very known positions on certain issues, then we'll probably see a very, very big difference moving forward.
Mm. It is, though, a fact that folks on the I came up with a new term last night. Extreme liberalism. Liberalism, but in the extremist form, right? Meaning to say that we're all liberal. I'm also, you know, I'm a feminist, but not an extreme feminist. I'm liberal, but not an extremist liberal. I'm not going to take it to extreme positions. In any case, you could see that folks on the anti-Israel, post-nationalist, post-Zionist, and also extreme liberal positions are very nervous, certainly, about Trump. There is a change of foot, potentially. In any case, the atmospheric is certainly leaning towards, there's no question about it, towards opportunities like those that that Education Minister Bennett mentioned, which is like it could be a turnover here of longstanding policy. And I agree that there's an opportunity here. But you know what's scary, and this is what I really wanted to talk to you about. We're great. We Jews are great, and I think in any political situation, it's easy to be on the defensive. It's easy to be complaining in opposition and complaining and picking, nitpicking. When you're suddenly in a position, thrust in a position of leadership and power, that's actually the scariest moment. You've been clamoring for it. You're fighting against the other side. Suddenly, you're in a position to actually do. Whoa! You get all of your weaknesses come out, all of your nervousnesses come out, and you become. You're actually called to do, and here's where you can actually fail or succeed. What do you think about that?
That reminds me of that Matthew Broderick movie, right? The campaign, was it, where he wins, and at the end of the movie, after going through this entire thing, looks at his chief advisor, who's going to be his chief of staff, and says, "What do I do now?" Like, you go ahead, you're living, especially in America, in this campaign, unlike here where it's 3 or 4 months of a campaign, you're living a campaign that's 2 years long. You're on the road for over a year and a half, going across an entire continent, 50 states, countless events, day after day. It's such a big deal that, yeah, you get to that point, you actually have to make decisions. Then you're like, wait a minute, I spent too much time trying to get elected. Now I actually have to be the president.
Right, but that's true in terms of Trump. I'm talking now in terms of the Israeli nationalist camp, which suddenly has seemingly a door open, because for a long time this is a radical change. We're talking about from Obama to Trump. We're talking about from the prince of progressiveness,
yeah,
to Trump, this political outsider who's and with Pence and other people, who's obviously kind of a no nonsense, no BS, nationalist, patriot, American patriot, and probably understood to be, pro-Israel and pro-Israeli strength. It's like a sea change.
That's why you need to always have a plan B. I remember back after 9/11, here Israeli politicians on the nationalist camp said, if only we had that Tochnit Megirah, we only had that plan in the drawer that we could just take out and use, we could have done that September 12th and nothing would have happened. And that's why a lot of people who might not necessarily like some of the alternative plans that have been raised by other politicians in the nationalist camp should realize that there needs to be this movement to think, what can be done? What is this plan B that we should be going forward on? Because, yes, I do think there is a better opportunity, a better chance than ever before since the start of the two-state solution that we see a change in paradigm and we see a change in policy. But we have to come ahead and say what that policy is. And if Israeli politicians are going to say, we're going to go back with the old establishment views, they have two dangers here. One, they're going to miss an opportunity of being able to work with someone who's coming, who's fresh and new. But the second thing, it may be more important for these Israeli politicians to understand, that same anti-establishment wave that has been sweeping through the Western free world can come and get them too if they decide that they're not going to open up to new ideas and try to continue to push older ones.
Very good. Okay, that was a great phrase. I really appreciate that. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, landofisrael.com, thelandofisrael.com. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And if you have any questions for our Knesset insider, knessetjeremy.com, who is always within the halls of power of Israel's ruling government elites and really the policies of how moving the state forward. So write me an email. I'll be sure to forward it to him and speak with him about it next time. Let's talk quickly now about two issues that are at the fore here in Israel. One is what seems to be a kind of radical step, but really it's not so radical, because in many European countries that is the law, and that is that we've got a problem with Muslims. Not in the sense that we have a problem with Muslim people, but we have a problem with one way that oftentimes religious, observant Muslims are acting around here, and that is with the minarets. The minarets, or what we call in Hebrew muazzin, are these things, these beautiful kind of religious part of the mosques, these kind of towers. And in these towers, they have today speakers. These speakers blare out Allahu Akbar and the call to prayer 5 times a day at tremendous decibels. Tremendous decibels to really, really reach out. Now, on the one hand, you could say this is a way for them to reach and to call to prayer. On the other hand, everybody could just look down at the watch or get a WhatsApp group or an SMS saying, hey, come to pray. But these calls to prayer are very loud. They go through Jewish neighborhoods as well, and they interfere with normal life, including the one that's at about 4 in the morning. And there's a law right now, a bill, that has not been passed yet, but it's moving ahead through the Knesset, which is to limit the nighttime usage of the muazzin. I always say, my suggestion is, I think it's great. Blare out Allahu Akbar at any time you want, but I want a guy to walk up those hundreds of steps to the top of that minaret and yell it out himself without the aid of without electronic noise making. I want to see you yell it out, buddy. You know, you get up there, sweat it out there, and belt it out. But don't use humongous speakers to completely deafen, wake up the kids, deafen the rest of us, and really be a noise pollution, which is a very common legal doctrine in most normative countries. Noise pollution is something that's illegal. You cannot make as much noise as you want.
Yeah, it's really interesting because if you look at the language of the bill, they'll be able to do that. And this bill is actually directed only at the public address system, so that just shows you that it's that they apparently don't want to do it themselves. But let's talk some policy here. We're talking about the amendment to the hazard prevention law. Now, this law goes ahead to try to make sure that you don't have situations of disturbance of the peace. Now, what we're trying to do here is balance two democratic principles. One is the freedom of religion, obviously, but the other one is the freedom to have a quality of life, and in this case, a good night's sleep. All right? So you can find a way to go ahead and deal with both. What this bill wants to do is very simple. Say you cannot use a public address system that is going to be over a certain amount of volume at certain points of the night. It's a very simple bill. It shouldn't
Seems simple enough. Shouldn't
necessarily be such a big deal. Why does it become such a big deal? Because it says that what it wants to do is do this specifically in places of prayer. Why is there a need to do this? The previous attorney general decided that the existing law does not count within places of prayer, what they call Beit Tefillah. So in order not to discriminate, we also wrote in this piece of legislation that this will go for every place of prayer, whether it is a church, a synagogue, a mosque. All religions will have to go ahead and follow the same rules. Now, I know there are some people who like their, you know, hakafot shniot on Simchat Torah. I know there are some people who might want to get really rowdy, really late, 2 in the morning on Purim. This is going to go to them, too. They can't use public address systems. They can use their own voices.
Because I'll tell you that where I live at the Western Wall, there are sometimes events, and you can hear them, you know, till 1 or 2 in the morning on Jewish holidays. And being a Jewish person living in the Jewish state, when I hear Jewish singing or praying happening at 2 in the morning during the Slichot period before Rosh Hashanah, I like it. Because I think to myself, great, my Jewish state is the sovereign. My culture is the culture that I want to see this country promote. I'm happy as pie. And if I think about this law, like a simple man like me thinks to himself, good, let us subdue some of the Islamic national and religious symbols here, because they should pay heed to the Jewish, because this is a Jewish state. And I'm not looking necessarily for religious tolerance and equality. I'm looking to actually get a good night's sleep, give people their rights, but certainly say, yeah, this is a Jewish state first. The reason we're mentioning this is because some of the ultra-Orthodox parties have issued some complaints about this law, and they're kind of stopping it from passing because they are saying this may affect things like the Shabbat horn. If you don't live in the land of Israel, you may not know that in places like Jerusalem and Bnei Brak, a horn goes off that blares throughout the whole city saying, hey, Shabbos is coming. Shabbos is now. It's time to light the candles. Now, and they're afraid that this may hurt that traditional horn letting you know about the Shabbat times.
Yeah, indeed. Both of the ultra-Orthodox parties, both Ashkenazi and Sephardi, UTJ and Shas, have opposition because of this reason. But like I said, we didn't write specifically because it was still in an early stage of the legislative process of what time we're talking about. But there was an agreement made between MK Moti Yogev and Minister Litzman, who's the one who put in the appeal to delay the process of the legislation. And the agreement was that we're going to be talking about from 10 at night, till 6 in the morning. So people can get that 8 hours of sleep from 10 at night till 6 in the morning. As you know, the Shabbat siren does not go off during those hours.
No, it goes off before Shabbat, which is before sunset, but by definition. That's when Shabbat starts, before sunset.
But again, going back to the fact that you have these liberals who are against it, again, when we actually talk about the policy of the bill, and not the politics, the policy is it's going to apply to all religions. And again, we're not going ahead and doing something crazy here. As you mentioned, this has been done in other countries. We're balancing two democratic principles. Freedom of religion is important. freedom of quality of life and getting a good night's sleep. That is a democratic basic human right as well.
So what you're telling me, and this is important to distinguish, is that what I said was exactly not what the bill is trying to do. It's not have, it has nothing to do with Islam or not Islam. It's not trying to do it. It's trying to say, hey, folks, it's fair for everybody in the society to get a decent night's sleep from 10 p.m. to 6 in the morning. And at those times, if the muezzin wants to go off, better go off in a WhatsApp group, a bell on your phone, a phone call to your house, or some kind of whisper or a knock on your door. But don't blare it out because there's other people sleeping who don't want to be woken up, including other Arabs, including other Muslims, including other Christians, including other anybody who just don't want to be woken up at 4 a.m. Also, by the way, the volume that they use is purposefully super loud. It's not like they're using it as a...
No. They do it on purpose, like you said. But 2 points on that. One, I talked with the bill sponsor, Moti Yogev. He said he got more thank you letters from Arabs than he did from Jews. Okay? Because he said there are a lot of Arabs, as you said, who they're even closer to the loudspeaker.
Sure.
And they're very happy that they'll now be able to get a good night's sleep once this is passed. The second thing there is, again, the political side of it, we were talking about the policy side, the political side gives you the opportunity to talk about what is being done here. And it's not just the high volumes. A lot of times they're using that opportunity to incite.
That's right.
And there are a lot of other issues that, again, are political issues. And it's legitimate to bring that up as part of the debate. But in terms of what the actual policy says, in terms of what the actual Israeli law is going to say, there you do not have a situation where you get into these political things that are being raised in the media. And it's important to also bring that side as well.
All right, we're sitting here on Nisim Bachar Street in Nachlao, Jerusalem, with Knesset Jeremy. Jeremy Sultan is our Knesset insider. His website is knessetjeremy.com. And go to that site for a lot of very specific polling numbers of Israeli public opinion and where it stands in terms of potential voting at any given time. Knesset Jeremy, I would only say to you, we want more from you on that website. We want more information about understanding how bills are moving forward and issues like that. That site is great. Your site is one of the only sites, really, in English that give you a sense of what's going on. I'm only saying to you, honestly, as a friend, more. We want more. We want more understandings. A lot more people want transparency. And here in Israel, transparency, and in general, politics has never been too transparent. Certainly here in Israel, when we get that transparency, when we get understanding, it really helps us. That's why we're doing this discussion on the show today. These are big issues. These are issues that are stirring up the country. Let's talk about just one more here, and that is a little community called Amona. If you drive north of Jerusalem for about 35, 40 minutes, you'll hit a beautiful town called Ofra. And it seems normative enough, only that Ofra is really in the quote-unquote West Bank, in the Benjamin region, which is southern Samaria. Beautiful town, very historic town. Lots of power people live in that town. Someplace that is really, in a sense, considered as normative as you get in the Judean Samaria.
Founded by Shimon Peres.
Founded by Shimon Peres himself. And if you go to that town and you look up, you'll see that there's like hills to the east and to the north of that town. And to the east, just a little bit above the town, if you just glance at it, you would think it's part of the town, is another a community which is attached by a road to Ofra, which is called Amona. I have been there many times. Beautiful town, beautiful little place. It's not really a town. It's a small, nascent community. And it's got in it, had in it one time, these beautiful permanent homes that were built. But those were destroyed just a few months after the Gush Katif evacuation/eviction, in a very contested, bloody fight between Jews who think that Jews have every right to live in these places and between the government of Ehud Olmert, who at the time followed a Supreme Court a mandate to destroy those houses because of the claim that it was built on private Palestinian land. Now the whole community of Amona is under threat, and this threat of Amona has mushroomed into something that's even threatening the coalition on one level or another, but it's something that is getting a lot of people heated up. And the reason is because the other side that claims that Jews don't have a right to live in Amona because it's private Palestinian land have really very, very, very unclear footing about what they base the fact that they claim that it's not Israeli or Jewish land. Supreme Court has sided with them, and this is becoming a referendum not only about this parcel of land, but also about the Supreme Court, about governance in Israel, about being able to overcome an unfair judgment. And also about the rights of Jews in Judea and Samaria in general, saying this is our land. I don't care what some weird, unclear claim of some Ottoman period or something is. We have every right to nationalize this land. So there's a lot of levels of a fight. And the fact is, it's really a very small, tiny little place. The offer has been made to move that community to an area close by. That's exactly what happened in Migron. Move the community and everybody will be happy. And other people saying, no, this is a principal issue and we have to fight. So, Jeremy, tell me a little bit about Amona and where the issues stand.
Sure. So there's a lot. Let's try to get through it step by step. You got, like you said, Amona, which some people say is a neighborhood of Ophrah. Other people say is a separate settlement. But you're talking about 40 families who are living on land where back in 1995 during the Rabin and Peres government, again, as I said, Peres had founded Ophrah. This neighborhood or additional settlement was also founded by this, by a later version of the same two people in terms of government. And they went ahead and gave the go ahead and make this community. Fast forward, we get to a situation where we have a court case in which some Palestinians come and say that they have, I'm looking for an English word for zika, but some sort of inclination towards this land. But they don't say that they have ownership of the land, which is a very, very, very interesting, complex legal thing I'm not going to go into.
They have some kind of connection to this land, but without being able to prove actual ownership or bona fide.
They don't even claim ownership, actually. They don't claim ownership of the land. But whatever, you're not going to hear that on most news outlets. So you have a very complex legal situation, which leads to the Supreme Court saying, okay, listen, what we have been able to understand from this, and later a public petitioner as well, is that this land does not belong. We've been convinced it does not belong to these Jewish people who were sent by Rabin and Peres. But on the other side, these people aren't claiming it's their land, so we know that it's not their land. So it's not their land, and it's not their land, so what we think is that it should be nobody's land. Everyone should get off the land. So you have the Jews who say, listen, if you want to kick me off, at least tell me whose land it is. And the Supreme Court says, I don't care. They instruct the state that they have to go ahead and remove these people that they put there. Remember, this is also something that a lot of people don't understand. These aren't people who woke up one morning, went to a hilltop, and decided to build a house. These were people who were sent by the Rabin and Peres government of 1995 to go ahead and sit in a neighborhood of an actual settlement that was founded by Shimon Peres when he was prime minister back in the 70s as well. So you have this situation which ends up getting delayed over and over again because the state keeps saying, we're going to try to fix this. The Supreme Court says, you should not have to fix this. We'll give you an extension, but you guys have to demolish. The state keeps saying, listen, we're going to try to find the owners. We're going to try to find, other types of solutions.
Now, let me just interrupt for a second, which is the state is also politicians. Politicians are people who are elected by the people. For them, this could be very costly. They're thinking to themselves, hey, I could really lose a lot of, I could get a lot of ire. My government could fall. I could really not be voted in the next time. I could pay for this. Even if I forget the issue of right or wrong, the Supreme Court has, in a sense, nothing that they have to worry about. Maybe it even shows their powers. They want to assert their power. The government's saying, hey, let's delay this. Let's not go there.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Supreme Court and what their authority actually is, okay? We have a basic law which has constitutional status. I'm not going to get into how that happened, even though we don't have a constitution. But we have a basic law called Chok-Yisod HaShvita that gives the power of the Supreme Court to oversee the decisions of the executive branch, of the government. What Israeli law does not allow is for the Supreme Court to intervene on the legislative branch, which is the Knesset. What we see here, though, time and time again, by the judicial activism of the last few, with the exception of Gruny's, Supreme Court presidents of Barak, Beinish, and now Naor, is an attempt to try to have the Supreme Court take to themselves authority that is not given to them through law and try to influence what happens in terms of the legislative process. Now, what this has brought us in this particular situation is to a situation where the Knesset says, okay, we understand, Supreme Court, you want us to destroy Amona. We disagree with you. You are not an elected body. We are an elected body. You don't have authority over us. We're going to pass a new law. We're going to make it a retroactive law. And people say, because you have already a decision of the Supreme Court, this is a okef bagatz. This is a bypass of the Supreme Court by going in that direction.
What would this law say?
And what this law says, and there'll be a lot of changes along the way, but it's only going to be specific to circumstances in which the government sent people, not unlike what's being reported into news where anyone goes and goes wherever they want, and then this will apply to them, only places where the government has sent you, and you're dealing in the complex situation, which you fall into here, where you don't even have ownership. You don't have someone who claims ownership of the land, which because of that, we can't rely on Israeli law or Jordanian law or British mandate law. We have to go back to Ottoman Empire law to actually be able to deal with this, which is, of course, ludicrous since the Ottoman Empire fell 100 years ago. But we're still, you know, upholding their laws in our courts right now. So what you have is a situation that will allow them to remain in their land. Because, again, here you have
the Amona residents
to stay in their houses. And like I said, you have this is another situation of a clash of two democratic principles. The problem I always have with people when they say it's anti-democratic is when they decide that one democratic principle is above the other. You have two here. You have one person who has, I'm trying to think of how you'd say schut kinyan. You have the you have someone say my property ownership, it might be violated here. And you have someone says I have the basic human right of being thrown out of my home and not having a place to live. Now it's pretty obvious that on the humanitarian
basic human
level,
right not to be thrown out.
Yeah, not to be thrown
out.
So
there's property ownership versus government. Let's call it violence or. Meaning to,
No. There's a difference of this is my land. I want money. Right, of let's say a landlord type situation.
Right. Let me explain what you're saying. Let me explain what you're saying. One of the claims is, let's say there is a different owner. Let's say an owner's found. Fine. There is a regular principle, which is if there is a mistake made and somebody's sitting on land for a long time, it's never been claimed, and then later on it's found that there's a different owner, he gets compensation. Fine, compensation. And that's what people of Amona are saying. If this is true, we'll compensate. Or maybe the government should compensate. But certainly not kick people out. Why should you kick people out? And that's a very basic idea in land situations like this.
It goes beyond that, though. Let's say the person who does own the land says, wait a minute, I can make money off this. Who says that it's my interest to be demolished? Maybe I want to get rent. Maybe I want to sell to them. Maybe I can make more money if it's not demolished. Who are you to decide that you're going to, for someone who's not even come forward, make a decision for them what to do with their land? Okay, so again, you have a little bit of a clash there. So what this bill in terms of policy is trying to do.
And who's putting this bill forward?
There's actually three separate bills that were advanced, and they're being merged into committee right now into one single bill.
Three bills have been passed at first call?
Preliminary readings. One was by Bezalel Smotrich of Tkuma. One was by Shuli Moalem of BITUD. And one was by Yoav Kish of Likud. Each one of those also has co-sponsors from UTJ, from Shas, from Yisrael Beitenu. Practically the entire government, you can say, is signed on, at least party-wise, into this bill. Where the argument comes here is, again, the question of who has more power over who in the terms of the separation of branches of our government. Even Moshe Kahlon, who is the chief opposition within the government to this bill, is not objecting that the Knesset is allowed, after the Supreme Court has determined that something needs to be done, that the Knesset doesn't have authority to overturn that through a new piece of legislation to make that legal. His issue is about making it retroactive. He's saying if you have stuff that are still in court, let's pass this and that will apply to them. But in situations where we need to do something in less than a month, that's already a retroactive situation that's too far for someone like me to get on board with.
All right. So these complexities have also caused a lot of rifts in Israeli society. I have spoken to some people who have told me, if the government falls because of this Amona thing, I will be so angry at the Amona people and the settlers because they have made a tiny issue into a big, you know, an anthill into a mountain. And other people are saying, no, this is not about Amona at all. This is about the Supreme Court and their ridiculous grip on our society, making decisions that just are not grounded in simple, plain logic, and they need to be They need to be deposed, in a sense. Their strength needs to be limited. They need, and this is exactly a fight against crazy anti-Jewish, a Supreme Court that doesn't even see the value of a Jewish state, the strength of a Jewish state, and basing itself on principles that are completely irrational. That's what this fight is really about.
Yeah, what we have right now is Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked and Beit Yudin, who is looking to appoint 4 new Supreme Court justices this year and a 5th one next year. There are 15 on the bench. That's a third. There's been no justice minister that over the course of one term has been able to appoint a third of the Supreme Court. I'm not getting into the complexity right now in the policy because of time of how that works, but what you have is an argument by a lot of people saying, listen, we want to make sure that we appoint 5 new Supreme Court justices. If we do that, we're going to not end up in this situation ever again. We already have people from previous rounds that were appointed to the court which are more conservative. This is a chance to be able to put it to an end a lot of the issues we're having. So you have a lot of people who are saying, let's not look at micro, which is the Amona situation. Let's look at the macro, which is appointing people to Supreme Court. On the other side, you have people who say, like you said, you need to look at the micro. If we're always looking at the macro and everything in Israel is short term and there's never any long term, then we're not going to get anywhere. And again, you have the frustration of people of we want our vote to be heard. It's very clear the people who voted for these parties do not want to see a situation like this unfolding. This is, again, the Knesset folding to the Supreme Court. This is, again, the way a lot of voters are understanding this, that you have the parties that are not listening to what their constituencies are asking them to do. Now, in terms of people say the Supreme Court will end up overturning it eventually, even if we do end up in a situation where the law passes and it does get petitioned to the Supreme Court, it takes time for them to hear that petition, to hear the state, to make a decision. In effect, that could even act as another extension, which would most likely take us already into the days of a Trump presidency, which we said already at the beginning of the talk today, could be a new horizon in terms of the way things are going to work.
All right. Knesset Jeremy, thank you very much for helping us understand that. That last one, the Amona one, is very complex. And I guess that's also part of the annoyance of it, which is like they're making it so complex that we, you know, the folks, you know, don't understand what they're basing their laws on. But you make a very good point, which is, hey, don't let this government fall. Make sure that this government with Ayelet Shaked as justice minister is able to appoint judges. That's a big deal to get her there. Let's not let this moment slip either. Knesset Jeremy, we're here on Nissim Bachar Street in Jerusalem. I want to thank you so much for joining us, helping us understand things. Next up is Rabbi Mike Foyer, Spiritual Cafe, also here in Nachlaod. Wherever you are, folks, I want to wish you blessings, lots of strength, and may the leadership of Israel be blessed as well. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, shalom and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Welcome back, that is. We're still in Nachlaot, and we are now at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, of course, with Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Hi, Yishai. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, and thank you for joining me here on thelandofisrael.com. And it's time now for some Spiritual Cafe, and we're moving ahead through the process of trying to figure out who Abraham is. And if there's a Torah portion about who Abraham is, it's really this Torah portion, which has kind of like adventure after adventure, l'havdil elf of the lot, to distinguish a thousand distinguishments, distinguishtudes. It's a little bit like the Odyssey in this week's Torah portion. It's like it's got these adventures, and every adventure will give you a little bit of an in into Abraham, his relationship with God, his relationship to his family, his relationship to this world. This is the Torah portion of Abraham, and Abraham's family. We're gonna kind of go into these if you want to understand the character, this is the character. And before we go on, I just want to say that this week's Torah portion, remember we talked about last week, and there was a lot of people who reacted positively to the idea, actually 2 weeks ago, the idea, or was it last week, the idea of living with the Torah portion and doing something for the Torah portion.
It was in Parshat Noach.
Right, Parshat Noach. We talked about it. For me, this week's Torah portion is really revolving around two places, and that is the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, this Torah portion is a lot about Sodom and Gomorrah, okay, and how they became that. And I remember that years ago I thought to myself, It's so funny, I thought to myself. Sodom and Gomorrah used to be these places, the centers of licentiousness, and ironically, they've become the places where the body heals. The body was abused, and people use the body in wrong kind of ways. And today, ironically, it's this place where you go to actually treat your body.
To the spa.
To the spa, to make it feel better. It's like the world's natural spa. And I found that the Talmud, I don't remember, sadly, I don't have the source, but I found a statement in the Talmud almost to that effect, which is like, yeah, today, God flipped it over and turned it into actually a place of healing, ironically. And it is a very beautiful place. And I would love to go tomorrow on Friday to the Dead Sea, take my family. As it is, the family is a little bit sick right now, not feeling so great, so I don't know if it's going to happen. The other place that I would go to if I wanted to really celebrate this Torah portion would be the city of Be'er Sheva. The city of Be'er Sheva, a very holy city, a very special city, a very foundational city. It's yet again mentioned in this week's Torah portion, and kind of the deal is done where Abraham gets the deed to Be'er Sheva. We'll go to that. Well, we're not in Be'er Sheva. We're in the capital of Eretz Yisrael, of the Holy Land, which is Jerusalem, but we are on Be'er Sheva Street. We're on Be'er Sheva Street here in Nachlaot at Beit Midrash Shlomi Yaakov. So I guess that's worth something, right?
I mean, I've been here for years. I love it.
What, but why call it Be'er Sheva? Why should like one town remember another town's name?
Well, Jerusalem is special that way because the neighborhoods have street names that are thematic. That's why this is Be'er Sheva Street, and over there is Shiloh Street. There are a number of city streets around this area. There's Givon, right? So it's a theme.
Right,
it's a theme neighborhood.
Does that screw up the mail sometimes? Does your mail get delivered to Jerusalem Street in Be'er Sheva?
Or something? No.
There is, of course, a Jerusalem Street in the Czech Republic. That's where the Jerusalem Synagogue is at. And there's two cities that like to call themselves the Jerusalem of Europe. Do you know what they are?
No. What are they?
Prague.
Uh-huh.
And Sarajevo.
Both. I never would have gotten Sarajevo. Yeah. Prague I might have gotten.
It's actually Sarajevo is the real city that calls itself the Jerusalem of Europe, and Prague is the second one. But in any case, there's a lot of places in the world that vie for being the Jerusalem or the Bethel or these places. But here in Jerusalem, we're remembering all the various holy cities, the very places of the Bible. Let's delve right into it. If you don't know where we are, of course, reading the Bible as we do, Jewish people, observant Jewish people. Finishing the cycle of the Bible every year. And right now we pretty much just started, and we're getting into the story of Abraham at chapter 18. Chapter 18 of the book of Genesis, Yudchet Sefer Bereshit. And we start with the story about Abraham. Abraham is recovering from the circumcision of last week's Torah portion at an advanced age. And suddenly he sees that there are these three quote-unquote people. They are either people, but they're obviously very quickly angelic people. They're people who are angels. They're people who have, they look like people, but they have information like angels. And moreover, they're going to do the good stuff of letting you know Abraham is going to find out that A, he gets healed by these angels. B, he's going to be given the info that he's going to have a son born unto him named Yitzchak, Isaac. And three, which is that these angels are coming down to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and flip those cities over because of the horrific cry that exists in the world because of them, because of the radical injustice that's happening there. These are the angels that are going to come to Abraham. Abraham reacts with really the word that I wrote here on the side is hospitality. He is very concerned with hospitality, and so that's one of the things that we learn about the character of Abraham. Hospitality. And in this case, it's also hospitality for the angels. We got to make a home for hospitality for angels like Abraham.
Well, I mean, it's just so indicative of his character that what he really wants to do is make a space for others in the world. I mean, and that's kind of his posture in relationship, and I think we can see it through the entire parsha, because here he is on the third day after his Brit Milah, right? And the Midrash says, like, what's he doing in the door of his tent, waiting, hoping, you know, just that some passerby will come and he can do some good. So I think that it's such a profound insight into who he is. He has this desire to enhance other people in the world, to really make that space for them. That's why he's so excited. And that's why it says that God sent these angels in the form of people, so that he could have that joyous experience of giving them hospitality.
I guess another way to look at it is that you would say that Abraham, being a spiritual person, may want to go to some kind of ashram get away from the world, become just deal with spiritual things and connect the yearning to connect to God. And here we see that, no, he's very much yearning to connect to man. God has to dress godly angelic creatures in man-like form so that Abraham could really give the attention necessary. He's very concerned with this world.
And that's the transformation we saw in last week's parsha with that addition of the letter He to his name. Because he was Avram, which in Hebrew literally means like high father. I mean, he was this sort of transcendent spiritualist at a certain point in his life who had these realizations that God was speaking to him. And but when God wanted to transform him in this mission of becoming a great nation, he added that He to his name, which is that letter of space. And then he became Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations, which is about bringing God into the world. And that's his mission. That's his great blessing. Like God says to him, Haye bracha, you're going to be a bracha. And that's a physical bracha of wealth, of food, of joy in this world. That is definitely his path.
And in order to continue that trajectory, you got to have a progeny. There's two kinds of progenies. There's your son, Ishmael. There's your servant, Eliezer. There's all the people that you've trained, but God says no. You're going to have a son, and I'm going to perform a tremendous miracle in this world. I'm going to overturn the natural course of events. You guys are beyond having children in terms of age, and yet you're going to have children, and you're going to have a child, and that child is going to be Yitzchak. It's like, why do it in such an unnatural fashion? And then there's the famous story of, there's a lot of laughter around Isaac. One of the first laughters is that Sarah kind of seemingly doesn't believe that it could happen. And she kind of laughs. There's like a laugh. It's treated rather innocently, like, kind of by the Bible. And yet, like, it's like, no, but you didn't believe it.
Well,
you
they both laugh.
Right.
We see laughter from Abraham. We see laughter from Sarah. And in this, right.
Maybe that's what we should do this week's Shabbat. We should do some
laughter yoga.
We should do some laughter yoga. Yeah. Or,
have you ever done it? It's actually a powerful thing.
Yeah. I have not done that.
It's a lot of fun.
I mean, I watch it's comedy a good laugh. Sometimes.
No. But intentional laughter yoga. We can do it maybe after the show. The power here is understanding what laughter is, because Yitzchak's name, as is true of all the names, that certainly ones given by God in the Bible, is indicative of essence, not just of some relationship to him, right? And that laughter has to do with the two faces of creation, right? When you're faced by a situation that seems beyond what you can comprehend, you can scoff. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, she's 90, he's 99. Come on. Come on, right? And God says, wait, I'm God. I'm capable of anything. And therefore, he sort of criticizes her laughter in the mind of the rabbis, right? Whereas Abraham, he laughs because he realizes the world is not as it seemed, right? And if you think about it, that's really the root of humor. Is when you juxtapose two things, which really you never would have thought to see together, mm-hmm. right? The rabbi, the priest, and the imam walk into the bar. Right there, you're already chuckling. Because like, what are they doing together, and why are they going to the bar? Right? You put those two things together, and it illuminates a facet of creation, right, which you never would have expected to see. And that's why laughter can be so liberating. And we're going to see that there's another theme that runs through this whole parsha, because in the end of the day, don't forget, that laughter culminates, you know where? On the altar. Because Avram is going to take in what appears to be the most absurd action, his entire future. He's going to take the promise that he received from God, to say, Ki bi Yitzchak yikare zaracha, right? That Yitzchak is going to be your future, your progeny, and he's going to offer him up on the altar. In the ultimate commitment to the idea that reality is not what it seems.
Mm. Well, we're going to get to that, because we're going to head to the penultimate Abrahamic test. Most people see it as the famous 10th test of Abraham, though some think of it as the 9th test. We'll talk about that at the end of the Torah portion. Just very quickly about laughter, I want to tell you one of my favorite Hasidic stories, and that is that one time the seer of Lublin, he would see a lot of people come to him for seeking blessings and fixing things. And one time, somebody came to him asking, dealing with a big problem, and he tried to reach the upper spheres, tried to kind of ask, you know, the court above for favors and dispensation. And he was like locked out, and he didn't know what was going on. And his soul kind of came back down to earth, and he said to the person, like, "I'm sorry, we're locked out right now." And the other great Hasidic rabbis also were kind of locked out at that moment, and nobody knew what was going on. It turned out that the famous Rabbi Naftali of Rupshitz was en route somewhere, and he stopped at an inn, and there was a Jewish wedding taking place, but the bride was crying. And Naftali Rupshitz said to the bride, he said, "What's the problem?" She said, "Well, we didn't have a joker, a badchan, a jester at the wedding, and I always wanted to have a jester at the wedding." He said, "No problem. I am a trained jester." And he went and he started making fun and merry and being the jester of the wedding. And it was so funny, and everybody was so happy and laughing that the courts in the heavens stopped working. And everybody just came, all the angels and even God himself came to listen to the court gestering, the barchan, the joking work of Naftali Rupshitz. And later the seer of Lublin said, "What I accomplish with tears, you can accomplish even more through laughter." And the Naftali Rupshitz was famous for his humor, for his jokes, and he made fun of everybody, including the other rabbis, and he was just irreverent and very funny, and he had a way of being heard through that irreverence. And maybe that's something of the name of Yitzchak, although we don't really, the Yitzchak that we're going to meet, not in this week's Torah portion, but next one, isn't that funny. There's
very little humorous about his life.
Right, he's not such a funny character at all. And maybe laughter, laughter isn't always linked to funniness.
I mean, so he's the laughter in the face of the void. I mean, he's the laughter that really shares a place with fear, which is so much of his life. I mean, you rearrange the letters of his name and you get Kate's Chai. You get the end of life, mm-hmm. right? And his whole trajectory is straight toward that altar. I mean, I didn't mention it when you said that we could make every parsha, you know, linked to some behavior during the week, but this could be sacrifice your kids week as well.
Right.
I mean, this is
or don't sacrifice
or no,
your kids.
Or try and have God stop you. Right. But there's something profoundly disturbing about the laughter here. It's like, is it inappropriate? Are you whistling through the graveyard, as we say? Are you mm-hmm. laughing in the face of some sort of void? Mm-hmm. Right. So we'll get to it in his character, but you're right. It's not funny.
No, it's not funny. It's not exactly funny. Anyway, speaking of not funny, there's a little argument about if Sarah laughed or not. She kind of denies it, and then God says, no, you did laugh. And that's kind of left without much explanation.
And don't argue with me.
Yeah, don't argue with me. But there's these angels that are at Abraham's house, and it's very dramatic. They look out onto the plains of Sodom. We know those plains very well. They're very, the Dead Sea plains. They look out there, and they're kind of looking at it. And then there's this incredible, incredible lines in the Bible, some of my favorite psukim. And it says, I'll read it in English. And Hashem said, in parentheses, to himself, "Shall I conceal from Abraham what I do, now that Abraham is surely to become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him? For I have loved him, because he commands his children and his household after him that they keep the way of Hashem, doing charity and justice, in order that Hashem might bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him." It's almost like cyclical. It's like, I love him because he loves me so that I can love him. Right? It's like we are so bound up together, and God like lets you, as an aside, like, and I can't hide these things from Abraham. And it's really the key of the word prophecy. It's like, I got to let you know what's going on because I'm doing stuff, and I'm going to let you know that I'm angry at Sodom and Gomorrah, and I want to wreck them. I want to destroy them. And then when he tells them, it's like, I told you, I didn't expect to get into an argument with you now, okay?
Well, it's not so sure. I'm not so clear to me that he didn't expect to get in the argument. I often read this, am I going to hide this from Abraham? It brings to mind that moment when God says to Moshe, "Get out of my way. I'm going to destroy all the people," right after the sin of the golden calf. And Moshe's like, out of your way? I mean, you're God. Oh, I get it. You want me to stop you. It's like on the playground when two kids are in a fight and one of them grabs his friend and hides behind him and says, "Yeah, hold me back. Hold me back," right? And, oh, if it's good, he's holding you back. I really think that what God wants here, he wants Abraham to stand up and demand something else.
Right.
The question is, what is it?
And so Abraham is going to argue with him about, and I'm going to say something that people are it's a little bit offensive, but Abraham is certainly, in my mind, the first liberal Jew. It's just obvious to me that his tendencies are, when I see liberal Jewish tendencies, I'm like, oh, I see that Abrahamic tendency. And I want to say that for both good and for bad, meaning that it's obvious to me that when I see, you know, liberal Jews, and I've coined a new term, by the way, extremist liberalism. There's like an extremist liberalism types where it's like, okay, you come from a good place, but you're taking it to extremist, and it's not different than extremist on the right and it's an extremist on the left. And I see that sometimes they have these Abrahamic tendencies. They want to. What is he doing now? The conservative position would be like, oh yeah, Sodom, it's got to go. The place has got to go. It's a cesspool.
Or more so, well, God said so.
Right. I accept.
Because I want to sharpen your terminology here, because I live this story is very important to me personally, and because of the teaching that I do in liberal Jewish institutions, right? One of the big questions that gets raised, and it's a real question, is what's the role for autonomy in religious life?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because there is a sense that religious life is about authority, right? God said, God gave me the Torah. The rabbis said, here are the laws, right? So in that sense, there is no role for my autonomy. My autonomy should take the form of obedience, because really authority trumps. And here, Avram's not a liberal. He's the root of Jewish autonomy. Right, that sense that the Jews are going to stand up even to God and say, yeah, but you know what? That's not how I see it. And that is one of the roots of liberalism today, because what Avram's doing is saying to God, listen, I hear you, and you're a God, and therefore you're an authoritative voice in this story. But nevertheless, my individual consciousness and my sense of what needs to be, that's what's going to trump right now. And that's, by the way, where I see one of the great challenges in the liberal Jewish world today, in the liberal world at all, which is, listen, I'm a believer in autonomy, because I think this story proves that autonomy is precisely what God created the world for. But there is no autonomy without authority.
The autonomy here is very limited. He's being an advocate, and he's also advocating with the judge.
Yes.
But the judge at the end has final, and he says it at every key phrase where he's arguing, just to make it clear what we're talking about. We're talking about that Abraham is going to offer up an argument that God should not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah unless he finds, and he gives different numbers from 50 to 45 to 30 to 20 to finally to 10 righteous people in the town, and God is going to acquiesce until the number 10. Okay, so if any, to me it seems like it's exactly what I was saying. It's not extremist liberalism. It's he's going to argue. You can call it autonomy. He can argue for humanity. He can in a more Kabbalistic type language, temper judgment. He can temper the judgment. But it's within borders. Like, that autonomy is with respect to authority.
Well, it's because it's all within the commitment to the relationship.
Right.
Because what Avram has is a deep commitment to God. And he says, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. His biggest problem in all this is the judge of all the world is not going to do justice. He doesn't get it. He knows God is judge of the world. He's committed to his role as servant of God. And he says, but this is not justice. And therefore, he clarifies the depth of God's commitment to justice. Now, why Avraham walks away at a certain point from the argument and doesn't go all the way is a very important question in that respect. And I think it indicates what you're saying, is that Avraham understands that his commitment to the relationship with God has clarified the sort of incredible nature of God's mercy. But nevertheless, God is still judge.
Right.
And so there's a point at which Avraham stops.
Right.
And he accepts that authority.
I think also in terms of being a Jew, if we go back to the question that I've tried to set out for us for this year, to think about the Torah portions of Bereishit and the character of the biblical family, the founding family, the character trait here, I think, if we put it in one word, is advocate.
Mm-hmm.
He's an advocate for truth, advocate for humanity, and advocate, and also an advocate for a certain amount of autonomy. But that advocacy is within the system. And if you think about what it is to be a Jew, and even a liberal Jew, it's okay, advocate for good things, but don't throw it all away. Just because you have some autonomy doesn't mean that there is no God or there's no authority. Don't throw it away. As you say, be committed to the system.
I've been taught to understand that this is
in the relationship,
the first true prayer in the entire Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Up till now, we've had people who spoke to God. We had people who pleaded and tried to appease God, Noah, right? But this is the first time someone stands up to God and says, no, this is not the way it ought to be. And if you think about it, when we pray for things like healing of the sick, or, you know, that I should have a better job, or whatever it is we pray for, intervention, what we're basically saying is, yeah, I know you're the almighty, omnipotent, omniscient ruler of the universe, but I see things differently. And here, Avram guides us down a path of saying, basically, what we're relating to God is just like we relate to our dear friends. When we see them acting in a way which is not their fullness, we say, listen, I know you better than that. This is not who you really are. And this is Avram, as you said, in the midst of the depth of his commitment to God, saying, no, God, I know you better than that. This is not what you want in the world. And that's how I understand God's setup. He says, Amichaselim Avram, I can't hide this from Avram, because this is what he's going to do in the world. He's going to bring out the fullness of my will.
Mm-hmm. Those are amazing verses, and it's not so common when the Bible, when the Torah will take this form of speaking, which is like kind of God will let us in. He's saying, let me let you into the way I thought at that moment, or I think at that moment. It's kind of like you have to have a certain awe when you read those kind of verses. The whole Torah is the revelation of God's will. But like within that, when you hear the revelation within the revelation, when God's like, this is how I think about Abraham, that's a very powerful thing.
It's an important tool for learning that I just want to emphasize for people. Anytime the narrative voice shifts is a place you need to pause and ask a question of why.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, and that was, by the way, towards the end of chapter 18. And you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Spiritual Cafe on the Land of Israel Network, here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, with Rabbi Mike Foyer. The next thing that happens is, so we had this incredible argument, and guess what? Like, this advocacy, and the Bible records it, but in fact, it doesn't work out. In fact, Sodom doesn't have 10 righteous people.
Rotten to the core.
It's really a messed up place. And we don't really know if Lot is really a righteous person there, or he's actually just saved for the sake of Abraham, you know, because when you have protector, things work out, you know. When you
That's
know
just the way it is.
But in any case, Sodom is really messed up. And this is as punishment is coming down on Sodom is when we're going to learn how bad Sodom really is. Two angels head to Lot's house. Lot shows characteristics like Abraham. He too wants to invite hospitality, wants to invite the guests in, a little bit less hospitable than Abraham, but still very hospitable. Suddenly, as the angels come to Lot's house, we hear the townsfolks gather around Lot's house, and they're like, get your guests out here so we may know them. And know them does not mean get to know them better. It means to sodomize them, and that's where the word comes from. Lot pops out. He's like, oh, guys, come on. You know, these are my guests. And then he says a very, very, very strange line. He says, I have two daughters. You could do with them what you please, but don't hurt my guests. What is that about? Okay, what is that business about?
First of all, I think it's just to deepen the sickness that lies at the core of this story.
Right.
And I don't think that there's any need to justify such a thing. However, I think that if you're going to understand it a bit in its context, it also shows the depth of the value with which this story began, which is that of hospitality, is that there is a bond of life that exists to this day amongst the remnants of the nomadic culture here in the Middle East, that when you welcome a guest into your home, that you are responsible for their life.
Right.
And that it is the violation of the deepest values of humanity to fail in that guardianship.
Right. And I tell my Arab neighbors and friends, I tell them, you know, you guys used to be great at hospitality. You're not like that anymore. And they say, you're right. They admit that they have lost through the jihadist milieu and the hate for Jews and for outsiders. They have lost a certain thing that I remember as a child, which I always thought was a very beautiful thing in the Arab culture, which was this hospitality thing. It's become much less so. And they admit it. They admit it to me every time when I accuse them of this thing. Any case, Lot is unsuccessful at trying to advocate for his guests. Suddenly, it's time for super angel power to activate. The angels, a hand comes out, grabs Lot back into the house. Very graphic details that the Torah gives us. And they're all struck. All these townspeople that are around the house are struck by these blinders, like lasers hit their lights. They're all blind. And yet they're still trying to find the entrance of the house and break through. Even the children, everybody's rotted to the core. They all want a piece of this anger, of this action, of this just evil act. They all want to sodomize and kill, and even the children are affected by this. And here's another interesting part, which is the angels tell Lot, they're like, okay, who do you got in this town? Your sons-in-laws, go tell them right now this town's being destroyed. And Lot does that. He wants to save his son-in-laws, and he speaks to the sons-in-laws, and they all mock him. They all laugh at him. And I hear a modern discourse, which is like, hey, there's a God, and he doesn't like what we're doing. And then the other person being like, you are living...
You fanatic.
Right, you're living in it. There's no God, and he's not going to punish, and all this. What are you... You're living in La La Land. And he doesn't get through to them. And then not only that, but Lot is going to be told, get out of the city, don't look back. We mean it. And Lot has a very famous word, Vitmamea. He was delayed. He was slow to leave. He was stuck to Sodom himself. The angels grab him by the hands. They're pushing him out of town. He's so stuck to this place. And yet the wife, Lot's wife, turns around and she looks to see if she can still catch that sale at the mall before we leave this place. How can we give up on Black Friday? You know, it's just so important. I need to be part of this thing. She can't let go. She turns into a pillar of salt, i.e., she's so mired in the place, she becomes physically part of it. Lot is saved.
And I think that that's at least the poetic essence of what it is to not look back, meaning it's possible to go somewhere and, well, it's possible to go somewhere and never leave where you came from. Meaning what we're talking about here is not just a physical salvation. We got to get Lot and his family out of town before the fire and brimstone come raining down. I mean, that's also true. But what I think is happening here, and this goes to the heart of the question of what you asked, which is, are they being saved because they're righteous, or are they being saved because of Abraham? Well, the hope here is that there is a future. There's a future that doesn't lie in the rot of Sodom. And the greatest danger is actually to bring someone into that future who's still holding on to the past. Because there's a part of the human being who just desires the life of decadence and flesh and self-service. Right? And if you don't eradicate that aspect of self, then thinking that you're going to build a future of service of God can very easily become service of self. And we've all seen it. Right? Religion is not a cure for the human condition. It's a vessel for taking it where it could go.
You know, as you said these things, Rabbi Mike, it stirred in me something that I've seen very much in the Aliyah world, which is that when I made Aliyah when I was 17 by myself, it was very hard to stay connected to American culture. Very hard. There was no internet. There was no internet.
You're lying.
There's
always been an internet.
There was no way to call your mom from your cell phone to her cell phone. Okay, I remember trying to reach my parents. It was so hard. But you couldn't watch your shows. You couldn't watch your shows. You couldn't be part of that culture. You couldn't listen to your radio. You could barely read your newspaper if you got, you know, your Jerusalem Post or something. You were so detached, and the beauty of the time was that you became matriculated into Israeli culture, into the culture here. And today, it's so easy to live here and stay in America. It's really incredible. It's unbelievable. It's like, and there's great advantages to that, but there's also tremendous disadvantage to that. And people get stuck in their language, which is the most obvious sign, and also in their mental state. I want to add one more thing to that, which is, today, culture is so pervasive and prevalent, we can easily become addicted, and I sometimes worry that my children are getting too familiar with that Western culture. I am sometimes jealous of the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi culture. They have certainly created enough of their own stuff. And I'm always trying to buy DVDs of the Bible, and when my kids are sick today at home and they're watching something about the Bible and, you know, about the Torah, and I'm so happy about that, but it's so easy to get stuck and mired in our own Sodom and Gomorrahs, and it's hard for us to pull away, and we get stuck, and God forbid we can turn into pillars of salt here.
Mamish, and the real power of what's happened is it's no longer being stuck in America per se, is everyone constructs their own world. I mean, we saw this in this last election. And all the shock in the liberal world of how could such a thing happen? Well, the answer is because all you're seeing is a reflection of yourself in your media. Mm-hmm. You don't realize there's a whole other world out there. And I see this a lot as an educator deals with a lot of students who come here from America, that the power of the virtual world, the internet, and especially now the phone with that personal access, is that you create a world which you never need to leave, and therefore you never actually arrive anywhere.
Wow. That's a very powerful thing. So we got to watch out for that word, Vitma. That Lilt got stuck. He was. How do you translate that? Well, you think he delayed. He
hesitated.
Hesitated, right? He couldn't leave Sodom so easily, even though he believed that Sodom was about to be destroyed.
Well, that's the power of it. It's not that he didn't believe them. It's that even though he could see the beginnings of the storm on the horizon, the leaving the past behind is not so simple.
All right, now let's jump forward to a completely different story, just for a second, and that is that when the Jewish people left Egypt. Suddenly, there's the Song of the Sea. Remember, after the splitting of the Red Sea, and the women take out tambourines, and they're singing, and they're doing it with the tambourines. And the Bible says, the Torah says, they took out the tambourines. And the question is like, well, when you're running from Egypt, and the Egyptians are pursuing you, are you like, don't forget the tambourine before we go? I need that with me. And our rabbis say, yeah. The women were like, there's going to be awesome celebration. Better take those tambourines. And similar to here, the next story in the Torah is Lot and his daughters. Lot and his daughters, they are running away from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. They're running, towns, sulfur, meteorites of fire and explosion are raining down on these big cities, and they're turning this green lush area into a forever salty, sulfurous place, and the whole thing is just this super, you know, X-Men type of, like, you know, dramatic action footage. And they make it into a cave. There's a bottle of wine in the cave.
Several.
There's a lot of wine here. Well, thank God for that, because the next scene is going to be the famous incest scene of Lot's daughters with Lot, from which will be born two nations, Ammon and Moab. There's the sense that the two daughters of Lot think that the whole world has been destroyed. Lot should know better, certainly after the first night where he gets plied with wine. He allows himself to get plied with wine a second night. And both of these daughters become pregnant from this incest. The Bible, again, does not spare
any of the details.
Right. Well, you know, it sets up the scene very clearly. We know exactly what happened there. And these two nations are born. And did I tell you this? I think I told you this last week. Did I tell you this? That I was at AIPAC this year. I told you this, right?
Yeah.
They used this stories to say to us, you see, we Jews can live in different ways. We can live in diaspora, you in Israel, because splitting up is not so bad. But here, these two anti-Israel nations will be born. And yet, while the enemies of Israel are being born from incest, while running away from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, so too is, the Messiah.
Absolutely.
The Messiah is coming through this dark episode of wine plying and incest. But who put the wine there, Rabbi Mike? Who put the wine there? How did it get there?
You know, Rashi just says, he's the man lamb, right? That it was waiting there.
It was provided for them.
It was provided. You know, and this, by the way, echoes, I keep coming back to it because to me it's the central story of the entire book of Bereshit, echoes in the same way that lamb, at the end of the story, when Abraham hears the voice of God saying, no, I never really wanted you to sacrifice your son, he looks up and there's that ram caught in the bushes. Right? And what do the sages say? How did that ram get there? Why? How long has it been there? Since creation. That what was waiting, actually, is for Abraham to see it. So in the same way,
caught in the bushes, that's such a... such an awesome
image. Yeah,
it's like caught up,
it's tangled up, right, in reality. It's snagged. Sheesh. In the same way, by the way, I mean, the image of incest here also echoes the hitma mea, that hesitation, the fear of leaving the nest and breaking out into something new, right? And that desire to continue life, which is a very real desire, but you know, why the Messiah is rooted here? Do we want to go there right now? Or are we gonna...
I think we have to.
You brought it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important because this is our first instance of learning about the Messianic process. Obviously, the Torah is not telling you that, but we're going to learn that way later when we learn about the Torah tells you, you see, you cannot marry these Ammonites and Moabites. They're the pits. Don't marry them. Then later it's like, well, what I meant to say was, don't marry the men folk, but the women folk, that's okay. And from there, it's going to come Ruth, this incredible convert, this proselyte, and she's going to be the progeny. From her is going to come King David. So it's like, and maybe we'll get to it later, the idea that Mashiach has to come through dark scenes so that he can avoid the gaze of the anti-Mashiach energy out there.
I think, and also in a more simple sense, is it comes to teach us that the Messiah is not some transcendent otherworldly force. That it's actually the Messianic koach, the Messianic power is rooted in the most earthly and sometimes even failed human elements, right? Because this is what God has given us.
So why don't the religious people see that the secular world could easily give birth to the Messianic period, and that's how the state of Israel was formed? It's so obvious to me that it's like a similar type thing. It's like you have it's not exactly, you know, a black hat type of Messiah that's going to come through this thing. It's going to come through other ways, and that the Torah lays it out for you. It seems almost like obvious to me.
I hate to say it, but I think it's because religion is one of the biggest things that stands between us and redemption right now.
We'll have to unpack that one. I don't know if we have the time.
I mean, in a very brief sense, I'll tell you that our master and teacher, Ralph Cook, tells us that, you know, really, we as a people have a covenantal relationship with God, right? It's an all-consuming relationship. It's not a set of beliefs, behaviors, and practices that sort of negotiates and regulates that relationship. That's what religion is. He says religion is a product of exile, right? Because when we lost that beautiful unity between our physical national existence and our spiritual service of God, so religion emerged. And what he doesn't say directly, but he certainly implies in many other places, is, well, you do the equation. If once we had this redeemed relationship and then exile came and what emerged from religion, in order for religion, for redemption to come, what's got to go?
Religion.
Yeah.
Well, religion is meaning to say the uptight, squared out, non-prophetic, kind of...
world-rejecting, abstracted, inhuman approach to the body, to the nation, to the earth.
And I do believe that the Hasidic and basically the more spiritual Kabbalistic revolutions that came really at the onset of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel were processes through which we came back to a real relationship to God, an unpacking of those suitcases of the diaspora back into a more natural mode where we're more spiritual, more connected to godliness, and not just through his technical details, which we needed to keep for the national memory to take place.
And this is why the real work of redemption lies in the physical work of being on the personal level, on the national level. That's why the promise to Abraham that we started off his whole story with was that he would be a great nation, not a great individual. Individuals can be incredibly religious. Right, they can, like you said, go live in a hilltop in a spiritualist environment. Nations are not spiritual. Nations are physically real. They can be redemptive in their commitment to the depth of relationship to God, which is capable only on the national scale and not on the individual.
All right, let's get back to Abraham, the individual, and how on his way to become a nation, because the next little story is going to tell us about one more of those times when Abraham is trying to survive. He's heading this time to the Gaza Strip. We all know how the Gaza Strip is. He's heading out to Gerar later on. Yitzchak, next week's Torah portion, we're going to learn, or in 2 weeks' Torah portion, we're going to learn again about Isaac and his sojourning in Gerar. And Gerar is basically Gaza today. It's somewhere probably to the west of Beersheba. Right, and kind of the if you ever been down there,
Nachal Besor,
we're talking about the real desert of southern Israel, and there's a king there named Avimelech, which means my father is king. And Avimelech grabs Sarah, who he's told is only the sister of Abraham. God comes to Avimelech, and he says, "Don't you lay a hand on her." Because if
why
you
does
do,
God always have a southern accent?
He doesn't always. Sometimes he's got a British accent. But in this case, he says, "Don't touch her." Okay, and he says, "If you do, you're gonna die." And Avimelech comes to Abraham, says, "Hey, you know, why did you do this?" And Abraham says, "I didn't think that you guys believed in God too much. I thought that you'd be willing to kill me for that." Avimelech doesn't exactly dispute that. In any case, he gives back Sarah. And at this point, something very important happens, which I think is probably very important to you, Rabbi Mike, which is really another instance in this week's Parsha of prayer. And this prayer is one in which we learn that all of Avimelech's household has been struck not only by inability to give birth, what do we call that? Infertility, but it's more than infertility. It's almost like they get plugged up.
Constipation.
They got full constipation. Like every orifice of theirs is locked up. And when he prays for when Avraham prays for Avimelech, and Avimelech is healed, his household is healed, not only is Avimelech gonna be healed, but Sarah is going to become impregnated at that very moment. And we learn an important principle, which I share with my friends all the time, which is the Jewish principle is pray for others. Pray for others for a similar situation. You'll see you'll get that kind of thing back. I always tell people, don't pray for yourself. You have a problem. You just laid out a problem for me. Good. Find somebody else with a similar problem and spill it on them. Spill it. Pray to God for them. And you'll see that's like such a suggestion the Bible gives us here, the Torah gives us to help yourself is pray for others. And moreover, when Sarah, and we'll get to that in a second, when Sarah is going to give birth, so are all the world's infertile women going to be kind of given that opportunity. The Abrahamic revolution, the Isaac revolution that's going to be born is going to affect everybody. Everybody's going to have this kind of bracha, this blessing.
This is a continuation of the story of Abraham's intervention at Sodom, and it happens through a very particular verse here. You know, because if you look in chapter 20, verse 7, after Avimelech says, "Hey, wait, you can't kill me. I mean, he told me she was his sister." And so God...
Avimelech is talking with God.
Right. So God says, "Vata shevet
in a dream."
Right? He says, okay. So he says, give back his wife. Ki navihu v'yitpalel ba'adcha v'chai. Because he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you'll live. Now, the critical thing is that this is the first appearance of the word navi and the word... The first word prophet and the first usage of the word pray in the entire Bible happens here together in the same verse.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes a long way to explaining what it is you just said. Is the idea that in order to receive something you yourself desire, the best way to do it is to pray for others. Why? Because what is the relationship between a Navi, a prophet, and prayer? Because a prophet is someone who knows God so well that they can demand that God show a more full face of his will in creation, even when the particulars of creation aren't showing it, right? They can demand justice, says Abraham. You're the judge of the whole world. You're not going to do justice? They can demand healing in this case. They can demand birth. And through that, what are you doing? They're actually creating the space for that to exist in the world. When I pray for someone else to be healed, in a real sense, as a prophet, when I pray as a prophet and not as some small creature begging the Almighty to do my will, which doesn't make any sense. Like, why would I, as a small creature, why would I be able to get God to do my will? Why do I know better than God? Maybe God wants me to be sick. And the answer is no. What God wants you to do is pray.
Mm-hmm.
Because God has told you already he wants people to be healed. He wants women to give birth. He wants the world to be at peace. What you need to do is make that space within you that you desire it so badly that it exists a little bit more in the world. And the trick is exactly what you said, is you'll never do that by praying for yourself.
Mm.
Because the ego and the smallness of what the rabbis say, that when we pray, we're like dogs saying, hav, 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 gimme, 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 right? That shuts down the world. That makes the world small.
Mm.
But if I can look at someone else and I can say, no, God, I know that you want people to be healed. I'm thinking right now of our beautiful friend Leia and how much prayer that we spilled out before God that she should be healed. And unfortunately, she wasn't. But I promise you, and as I spoke to her about once, that much more healing came into the world because of that tremendous desire we had, not just that she be healed, but that there be healing in the world. That's the role, and that's why we say Am Yisrael. If we're not prophets ourselves, we're children of prophets, because our task is to make that space for healing, for peace, for mercy, for justice in the world, so that God could be more manifest.
All right, folks, those are key words. I can't highlight that enough. If we're gonna go through this and try to understand who Abraham is and who we are as children of Abraham, what is the characteristic that we have to emulate? You heard it here, which is that we got to make a space in this world for those qualities to happen. And in simple terms, pray for others. You'll see it by doing it. You'll understand the words by doing it. It changes everything. So think about that problem that you want God to help you with, and then take the time to look for another person. Take the time. It takes time to find a person in a similar quandary.
And the work to care. Mm-hmm. It can never be mechanical. Don't misunderstand.
Right.
It's not, you're not pulling one over on God. Like, oh, right. I want a job, so I'll find somebody else. No. You actually have to care.
Right. That's true. But I think that even if you fake it till you make it, meaning to say,
oh, sure.
The minute, if you're even gonna take time to think about something else, it's gonna, like, you're gonna see magically. You're gonna be like, wow, you know, I really hope that does happen. And when you will hear Sorot Tovot, when you'll hear good news, it'll be a tremendous satisfaction for you.
Amen.
Great story. Great stuff. All right. So now Abraham prays for the house of Avimelech. Again, a Gentile, not a Jew. It's not
Kosovo. Well, everybody is at this point.
Right. Right. But he's praying for somebody else. He's praying for somebody who, you know, whatever. The character is not necessarily the simplest character, Avimelech. He's praying for them, and he gets Avimelech's house gets heard, and so too the Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, is impregnated. Her skin becomes soft. She, you know, the Torah says to us earlier, she has lost her she's gone through menopause in a sense, and she's lost her ability to do it in the natural fashion. God has made this incredible miracle. One of my favorite verses is that it says that Abraham circumcised him on the eighth day, and then Sarah says, God has made laughter for me. Everybody who's going to hear this is going to laugh for me. I think here we have to laugh a little bit. Like, we have to, when we hear, like, the good news that Isaac was born, we have to be like, that's amazing. And one of the things that stands out here is that there's a verse that says, Sarah says, she continues and says, who would have thought, who would have said that I would have nursed children for Abraham? And Rashi and the Medrash says, what do you mean children? Did we not get part of the story here? You had one child. And the story goes that at a big party that they had for the birth of Yitzchak, everybody was like, oh, come on. You know it's not true. They didn't have a baby. And these are important people. These are ministers and important noble men and women. Come on. You know what happened. They stole the baby. They adopted a baby. Now they're telling us this cockamamie story about having a baby. Please. We all know they're too old for that. It didn't really happen. They're full of it. The Jews are liars. And what happened was is that all these people brought their babies that day, and suddenly the babies start crying. 100 babies start crying. They're all, wah, wah, wah. And instead of a party, there's a cacophony of noise. Suddenly, Sarah says, no problem, and she nurses them all. 100 babies.
Up.
She knocks them all out. And you know how babies are when they nurse, they're like, They're like, I'm asleep. I can't. I'm just full of milk, and I'm just done. And she nurses all of these babies. I remember that one time one of my older boy was at somebody's house and he started crying, and Malka and I were away, and the mom of that she was staying at he was staying at nursed him, and we were like, what? Somebody else nursed our child? That's so weird. But like in other times, that was a kind of normal thing.
Nursemaid, sure.
Anyway, so Sarah nurses everybody, and everybody's like, oh, I guess she does. She did give birth because she had that ability. That reminds me so much of how oftentimes we are told that we are liars and thieves and our whole story is contrived. And yet, at the end, what we want to do is give milk to the whole world, which is be a light unto the nations.
There's also a deep, almost a metaphorical message here, in that people's inability to believe this story goes straight to Sarah's laughter, right? Because her laughter is transformed here from her original sort of skepticism to Avram's laughter of like, oh, wow, the world is actually not what I thought it was. And Sarah wants to feed them from that, right? Because what is mother's milk? Mother's milk is the ultimate source of life. It becomes everything. It tastes like everything. And she says, listen, I know you're in your constructs, in your rational world, and you've been a professional for a long time. You've been around the block, and you know how the world works and all that stuff. Let me just bring you back to the source and just open you to the freedom wow. that's there when you understand that the world is not like you think. And that Akoyachol, God can do everything, and that's the source of life.
Okay, so we have all this laughter, go back to the source, motherliness. By the way, my daughter asked me the other day, she says to me, if milk comes from a cow and a cow is fleishik, it's meat, why isn't milk fleishik? Like, why do we think of it as an opposite to the meat that we ate?
That's a very profound question.
Right, and mm-hmm. I told her, I said to her, the difference is that milk is life-giving. The animal's not dead, quite the opposite. It's very much alive. And meat is the exact opposite. It's kind of taking away life. It's red versus white. It's a very different kind of energy. And she accepted
she got that.
She accepted that. It was just interesting that she asked that kind of question.
You've got some challenges in your future, my friend.
Yeah. My daughter asked me, my favorite question that they asked me recently is that I told them that we can have a coin collection of international coins. So my daughter's like, but can I touch it on Shabbos if it's not valuable to me?
How old is she?
She's 9.
Oh, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, she said to me, it's not valuable. And then I'm like, let's ask a rabbi. Next time we were at a rabbi friend, she asked him that question. And he said, yes. He said, if it's not valuable to you.
If its purpose is as the collection and not as money.
Right. It's right. Just an interesting thing that happened. Any case, so we just had all this good energy, motherliness, joy,
yeah, I'm
laughter.
Feeling warm and fuzzy.
It's warm and fuzzy. Except that.
It's all going out the door.
It's all going out the door right when the next section comes in, which is, oh my God, beautiful baby Yitzchak. This is great. This is wait a minute. There's another son here. His name is Ishmael. He's got a totally different kind of energy. And those energies are not mixing well in the household of Abraham and Sarah, the real wife, right? As opposed to the kind of
handmaiden,
concubine, whatever you want to call it, second wife, says, hey, I'm seeing how these boys are growing up and their cultures don't mix. He's an Egyptian type. He's the son of an Egyptian princess and he's growing up as an Egyptian. And we see that a few times, that word Egypt. Connection to Ishmael is a recurring word.
Absolutely.
He marries an Egyptian woman. He comes from an Egyptian mom. And it's not working with Israel here. Egypt and Israel, they don't mix. They don't mix well. And Abraham, I want you to kick him out of the house. Say what? I said, you got to kick him out of the house.
And let's remember that's into the desert, not like to the five towns.
Right. He has to leave from Lawrence to Woodmere. No, he says... She's like, he's got a... Not only that, you remember that thing that you didn't have children for like 100 years? Remember that son that you've been raising that you circumcised at the age of 13? Ishmael. It's no joke. Ishmael comes from Hagar, who's seen the angel of God. It's like his name is God. God will hear. And I want you to kick him out. And Avram's thinking, well, there's always been enmity between Sarah and Hagar. We faced that episode before, but now she wants him out.
She's thrown down the gauntlet, so to speak.
It's either me or her.
Right.
It's either my son or his son. And the what I would call, and you may disagree with me, the first liberal, the first Jewish liberal, and I mean that again in a beautiful way. I mean, liberalism, I don't want it to be, God forbid, misunderstood. Liberalism is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to honor. Nazis are not liberal. Jihadists are not liberal. Jews are liberal. We see the inherent liberty that every human being deserves and the value of every human being. But sometimes that could go too far. In this case, Abraham's like, this is very bad in his eyes. Very bad, says the Torah. Very bad in his eyes. And he's got to bring it up to the judge of judges. And God says to him, God does not release an order saying, kick out Ishmael and Hagar. He says, Sarah's right. You got to listen to her. Shema Bekola, very famously. And the way I translate that is, she saw something that you didn't see. You didn't need my prophetic thing. You have to see it with fleshly eyes. You can't miss this point on your own. Ishmael's got to go. And don't worry, I'm gonna bless. I told you before that I'm gonna bless him, but he's got
to
go.
Yep. This story to me is bound up with part of the pain of what it is to be a Jew, to be Am Yisrael. Because this is the part where, as you were talking about liberalism, I was hearing the voice of my father, Oliver Shalom, saying, it's good to be open-minded, but don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out. That we as a people are absolutely in service of human liberty. We're absolutely in service of human dignity, of freedom, of all those beautiful values that the world associates with us, rightfully. And yet, in order to be in service of that, we must be ourselves. And the great danger that we see in this story is the danger of being swept into or invaded by the foreign culture, right? The culture here of Avodah Zarah, the culture of Egypt, and I think you're absolutely correct that the sort of literary backbeat of the relationship there is Egypt, 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 and don't forget where we're heading and what we're trying to get away from and how much. I mean, look, as a people, we're still processing 3,500 years later, the slavery in Egypt. It's not a small thing, right? And so I think that the pain that Avram feels here is right up there with the pain of circumcision, which is definitive of what it is to be a Jew.
You just got to feel bad for Abraham. You just got to feel bad for him at that moment, that he's faced with this. And I guess now that I'm just talking with you out loud, this is an Akedah. There's two Akedahs here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it,
when I say Akedah, means the binding. It's like later on, of course, the next we're going to get to right now, which is the binding of Isaac. But this is also binding. Kick out your own son out of your own house.
And in a sense, this is more of a challenge for Abraham than for Ishmael, as opposed to the binding of Isaac, which is really equally a challenge for both of them, because at least in the surface of the story, Abraham and Ishmael know that he's going to survive, that he's going to become a great nation.
Well, he almost dies.
Right. He almost dies. His mother gives up there, but there's a divine promise that he himself will survive.
Right, but there's a moment there where in the Torah tale, the water dries up. There's some kind of negligent usage of water here, of resources. And
she drops him under a bush and walks away because she doesn't want to see him die.
And she walks away at a distance of the shooting of an arrow.
Right.
Which is giving us a little kind of sense of there's also a violence, a warfare type of characteristic trait here. That's the way things are measured. And
it's a story of judgment. There's sharp lines being drawn.
Right.
Abraham says, I don't think I want to do this. And God says, no, your wife is right. Draw the line. And Hagar, in the same way, says, like, I can't watch this. I'm going to drop this kid here and walk away.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's God's mercy that saves them both, really.
Mm.
And we're about to see the ultimate drawing of the line where Avram's going to put a knife to the throat of his son.
In this week's Torah portion, Avram almost loses two sons, basically. And
ultimately, at least in the eyes of the Midrash, the consequence is that in next week's Parsha, he loses his wife.
Wow. All right, we're going to get to that next week. Just before we get to the big story of the binding, and you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show on the Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com, Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov for Spiritual Cafe. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. We got two more little things to cover here. One is that the same Avimelech, there's a little, how do you call it? Like a little sip of like liquor between the two scenes, you know, just not to juxtapose it too much of Ishmael and Isaac and the binding. There's like a little sip here to cleanse the palate. And that sip is the story of Avimelech. Avimelech is going to come in and he's going to get Abraham is going to give him a hard time about the stolen wells. He's going to say your boys stole some of my wells,
encroaching on my land.
You're encroaching on my land, and here's another Abrahamic trait. Don't you know? You may be liberal one way, but that's the thing about Abraham. He'll welcome you into the tent, but if you take his nephew, he's going to war with you. He's going to pray for you, but if you're going to steal his wells, he's going to give it to you. He's going to tell it to you straight. That's a very Israeli characteristic trait.
The truth is also a liberal value.
I guess, but sometimes you may, like, you know.
No. It is a true liberal value. because the truth will set you free. Mm-hmm. Right? It's about liberty.
So finally, what's important here also is to know is that they're going to cut a deal that Abraham dug this well. They're going to set out seven sheep by themselves, and these sheep is going to be like a sign. And Abraham, Avimelech is going to say to Abraham, "What are these seven sheep?" He says, "These seven sheep are a sign that I dug this well, which is called seven, the well of seven." And they signed that deal. Abraham gets by covenant the city of Be'er Sheva. And there he planted an eshel tree, a tamarisk tree. A tamarisk tree is very special because under it, it's about a degree or between 1 and 3 degrees cooler, because the tamarisk tree releases a little bit of liquid, and it kind of is like cooler under that tree, and therefore
it's a microclimate,
and you're going to come under that tree. Abraham is going to bring people into under that tree and teach them, okay? And he's going to call in the name of God, the God of the universe. That's what happens in Be'er Sheva. You know what? I'm always a little bit frustrated that we don't make Be'er Sheva into a bigger deal. It is such an awesome biblical city. And if you look at the map, here's a surprise for all of you. What is the center of the country? Sure, Tel Aviv is considered the center of the country.
Culturally
and economically. The spiritual center, of course, is Jerusalem. But physically speaking, if you want to see the state of Israel today, the dead center of
it is Be'er Sheva, for sure.
Be'er Sheva. And it's just, I don't know if it's got the love that people should have for
Be'er Sheva. It needs a lot of love. I lived there for about 6 months. It needs more love.
And it's getting more love now with the army moving down there and stuff. So that is the city of Be'er Sheva. Any comments on that? Here we're sitting on Be'er Sheva Street.
I mean, the one thing I would point out is this name here, this V'krasham B'Shem Hashem El Olam, right?
God of the universe.
No. Because that would be El Ha'olam.
Right.
Right? That
God of eternity.
This is the world God.
World God.
Right? Meaning he's bringing people in and teaching him that very important essence that God does not lie outside the world. Mm. That the way to God is not to reject the world or transcend the world or to spiritualize the world. The way to God, of course, what's he doing with people here? As the Midrash says, he brings them under the street, gives them food to eat and you know, water to drink, and they all say, oh, and then, now he says, now thank the one who gave you the food. They say, oh, that's a little awkward. I guess, yeah, thank you. He says, no, you think I gave you the food? No, God gave you the food. I mean, the world is a gift, and God exists in the world, and eating the food of the world and walking the streets of the world is a way to know God. There's a very important part of his path that happens here.
And he's also setting up a ministry here, if I say. That's the kind of Christian term. One time I was at the Kotel, and I met these folks, and I told them what I do. They're like, hey, this young man's got a radio ministry. Okay, and I remember that word. But under that tamarisk in Be'er Sheva, finally owning a piece of kind of property, Abraham sets up ministry.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the land of Israel. So, okay, you've had a son. You've had your second son now, or your first son is Abraham, now with Sarah. You set up your ministry, and things
are starting, looking good.
Things seem to be normalizing, finally.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
But, you know, and you just, this is how love of the Bible comes about. You just got to see that the Torah is taking you on an up and down journey. It's taking you through dramatic, feelings and senses. And as things are going real good for Abraham, he's an old man now, he's done a lot of work. God says to him, you know that beloved son of yours, Isaac, I want you to sacrifice him to me. I want you to, not only that, you know all that thing that you do about there's one God and he doesn't want us to sacrifice our children to him? Yeah, that's exactly what I want you to do. That one son that I promised you, the one that's going to carry on the trajectory, yeah, I want you to sacrifice him to me and go against everything that you've ever done. And you know what? Are you going to argue with me? Are you gonna, like, because you argued with me about Sodom, about Sodom. Are you going to argue with me? No. There's silence, seemingly. Contemplative 3-day walk journey, which famously Soren Kierkegaard is going to kind of analyze these 3 days. What is he thinking, this Abraham, as he's walking towards Jerusalem about to offer up his son, Isaac? I know you have a, Rabbi Mike, I know you have a special connection to the Akedah.
Yes.
The binding.
There's so much here I don't really know where to begin. But I guess to begin in the beginning is the best place, right? Is it so important and often miss this word na, right? That v'yomer kach na et bincha, right? Please take your son.
God says to
God
Abraham.
Says to Abraham, because it's critical to the understanding here to know that this was not a command. God did not command Abraham to sacrifice his son. He asked him to. And in that, it so deepens what people find to be a problematic element of this story, which is how could God, I mean, okay, God commanded, then we can just say Abraham submitted. And then this is a story about Abraham's absolute submission and, okay, fine, although that is deeply inconsistent with the rest of his story, so it would be problematic. It's not what this story is about at all. Because God asked.
But that inconsistency is also there to teach you a message, which is you have to know, as we talked about a little bit in the beginning, you have to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, you know?
Yeah, sure.
It's like,
but
it's
a story of this drama is, I don't think that's it. You want to know what this story is about to me? Because don't forget, there's two participants here. There's Avram and there's Yitzchak. And as much as Avram is the one who puts Yitzchak on the altar, Yitzchak is the one who has to get down. And that whole question of what the world looks like after he comes down off the altar, I think illuminates.
And he submits himself.
He absolutely.
He told we just all we get. We it's very quiet. The Bible gets laconic here. It does not tell us much. But he is bound up, and the Medrash will add in like you know he's basically going to submit himself to be tied up so that he doesn't struggle, so that he can come to be sacrificed in perfection, in purity, so much so that he kind of at that height and at that spiritual moment, he gets a glimpse of the higher spheres, so that the tears of the angels fall into his eyes.
Well, let's wait to talk about that. That comes much later in the next phase of the story. But and don't forget that, of course, Abraham heard this from God, but Yitzhak heard it from his father, which is not a small thing. But the key here, I think, what is being asked of Abraham is the question, did you get it? When I said to you that you're going to have a son and you laughed, that tzchok about realizing the world is not what it seemed. Did you think that meant sometimes God will do for you? I mean, look, really the world is what it seems, but sometimes God will do for you. Or did you get the depth of what I was teaching, which is that the world is actually completely dependent on my will and nothing else. Everything is contingent upon my will and nothing else. And therefore, I want you to embody that in this moment. Because the absurdity, as Kierkegaard calls it, that absurdity of holding those two thoughts of sacrificing Yitzchak and Yitzchak being the future cannot be held in this world. And God says, now I want to see if you can hold that and move forward and truly embody what it is that Yitzchak is. He's offering Yitzchak's essence back to God. That laughter about a new way of understanding the world is now embodied in the action of the Akedah, which is why, of course, a whole new relationship with God emerges. Because don't miss it also that it is Elohim, the God of the world, right? The master of all the forces of the world who speaks to Avram and asks him to sacrifice. But it's Havayah, it's the four-lettered name of God who stops him from doing it. And that's a revolution. It's a revolution which Avram embodies when he realizes, oh, the Absolute sees me. Hashem Yireh, God sees. Why is that such a new thing for Abraham? Why does he call this place Hashem Yireh, God sees? He's been interacting with God the whole story. But if you look back, it was Elohim that told him that Yitzchak would be his future. It was Elohim who told him to sacrifice him. But it's Havayah who points out to him that you, in your individuality, exist in the face of the Absolute because you have a relationship to me. And that's all that matters.
The Akedah, the binding, is... You know what frustrates me? You ever meet these people who are like, how could God have done this and that?
All the time. My students say it all the time.
And I'm just like, don't you see that the moral questions are not like you just like figured out that like there's an inconsistency and a problem here and there, and therefore it's all bunk. It's like it's set up to be a moral question. It's there in order to challenge you and to think about it. It's like the beauty of it. It's not that you've uncovered a dirty corner in the Bible, which there's a problem and like the whole thing is bunk because of that. It's the opposite. It's like it's so gorgeously set up to be this moral dilemma that you gotta struggle with.
Well, you know what I like to point out to my students, because I've had this discussion. I'll be having it soon again. I promise you. We're not in session this week, but Monday, I promise you, it'll come up. One of the things I always point out to them is that the whole story starts is Vayachar Dreimayel. After these things happen, the Elohim nisa et Avraham, And the word nisah is very important.
He tested him.
So he tested. That's the first reading. Now, a test, you know, if I were a fifth grade teacher, I'd test my students to know what they know. See, did you do the work? Right? But that's not relevant by God. God knows exactly what Abraham knows. So another level here that why you test students is to show them themselves what they know.
Right.
Right. And there's something which is in potentia in Abraham that needs to be brought out here. And that's like another level. But the deepest level is the Ramban points out that Nisa also means Nes in the sense of a flag. It's a flag. Why do you have a flag in war? Why do countries have a flag? Because it's a point of reference that when you're in the midst of chaos, you look and say, ah, that's what's real. So I pointed out to so many students, there are 4 billion people on this planet who look at this story as a seminal moment in human history.
Right.
Now, if you're going to tell me that you, in your personal sensibilities, find it a difficult story, then I will say, great, be bothered by it. But hold that fact. Half of the human species knows this story and sees it as a turning point in creation. You cannot dismiss it lightly.
Rabbi Mike Foyer, I got to go pick up my daughter pretty soon from school, you know, or else she'll think I'm putting her on the altar over here. It all comes down to real life. We have to teach the story to our children, and it's meant to be this incredible story. It's meant to challenge us. We're not supposed to kind of be not bothered. We're supposed to be bothered. We're supposed to learn through it. Abraham at the end is about to sacrifice his son. He takes out the knife. And God says to him, don't do it. I that wasn't really the test. I just want to see kind of if you would be willing to do it, if you would be willing to sacrifice your beloved, your firstborn. And a simple reading, it's who do you put first? It's my world or is it your world?
But on a deeper reading, that actually God transforms Abraham in that moment. He is not, he says his name twice. You know, there's 3 voices that Abraham responds to in this. And he says Hineni to each of them. He says, here I am. First, it's Elohim. He says, here I am. I'm ready. I'll do it. And then it's Yitzchak calls out to him. He says, here I am. I'm still your father. I'm not some religious automaton that has forgotten you.
Right.
And then it's Havaya. It's the 4-letter name. But there, God says his name twice.
Right.
That first one is a breaking of the old Abraham. Shattered. He can't. That reality no longer exists. The second is this new Abraham who's in a fundamentally different relationship with God. And God's saying, I never actually intended that at all. Not as I take it back. This is a different world. And you know where we really see this? Is the sages say that Abraham actually did it. That he sacrificed Isaac. That he burned his body on the altar. And that his ashes rest before God for all eternity. As an intercessor for the people of Israel. That we have given it all to you already, God.
And when one thinks of those images that you just said, one cannot not understand that the Jewish people have also been sacrificed so many times. I think about the Crusaders burning Jews in synagogues in Jerusalem or throughout Europe in 1099 here. I think about the expulsion from Spain, the torture that Jews went through when they would refuse to be any other but Jewish and beholden to their truth and faith. And I think, of course, about the Holocaust. You got to believe that there's a moment in the Holocaust where we were like Isaac as a people, were sacrificed only to kind of be reborn, to come down off that mountain and to come to a new reality, as you're talking about. And all this, another level of all this is that we're talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about the temple. It all happened on Mount Moriah. This is the land of Moriah. This is where the Bible uses that term. And God will be, he will see, he will also be seen on this mountain. And this is where it all took place. And this is all a prelude to a temple and a temple service, which the Jewish people serve God, but also the world came to serve God and will come to serve God. That's an incredible thing. Finally, and just because of limitations of time, the last little scene is after he comes down, Abraham hears a message. Guess what? Rivka is born. Are you awesome? Are you incredible? And I'm with you. There is physical continuation. Back to the world. Back to like Beersheba. Back to the world.
Back to the purpose.
Back to the purpose. Rebecca has been born. There is a Rebecca out there. And next week's Torah portion, we'll have to fish out Rebecca from Haran and bring her to the land of Israel. Rabbi Mike, I want to thank you so much. There's so much more that we can talk about the Akedah.
Oh, my.
And hopefully, Bezrat Hashem, we'll do it on next year's pass as well. And I urge everybody to contemplate, to think about the Akedah. And also, I would be remiss if I didn't remind people that you could come visit certainly Jerusalem, where the temple stood and will stand, and Hebron, where those people, just like we talked about the ashes that are always before God, those great people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah, are buried and waiting for you. They're really not totally buried. They're kind of laying there asleep in kind of beds, and they are waiting for to be kind of jolted out to say the time of the redemption has come. So I want you to come and visit, and therefore write me an email and learn about being able to visit Hebron. That's where I work in my day job, which I'm very thankful for to God. And that check out our website, hebron.org.il. Check out the other shows here at thelandofisrael.com. Check out Sulam Yaakov for more Rabbi Mike's great lessons. And also, of course, on our network, thelandofisrael.com. And the Jewish Story.
The Jewish Story.
The Jewish Story is your new podcast on the network. And there was many more ads and things that I wanted to talk about on the show. I will do so more next week. We just had a very long program, but all this stuff is very important. So write me an email. I want to hear from you. Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Be strong out there, folks. Folks, remember, the enemies, they have Al-Qaeda. We have the Al-Qaeda. Okay? They have all kinds of forces to try to destroy us, and we have the binding, which is always before God, the story of the Jewish people. And now we're coming down off from the binding and into a real Jerusalem in this world. We are part of something amazing, something great, something that we all have to be part of, because that is the time that we've been born into, the great time that we've been born into. And you are a part of it wherever you are. So stay tuned, stay connected, stay strong. God bless you wherever you are. And Shalom.